Hey all, something a little different today. I really enjoyed this next conversation. And it's with Michael Franzese, who was a mafia boss featured in Forbes magazine, one of the richest, back in the 70s and 80s. And he did nearly 10 years of hard time and then came out born again, basically. And he has since been lecturing and giving inspirational talks to schools, universities, corporates all over, on how you avoid gambling problems and generally avoid crime. So a great guy, fascinating character. We touch on his fascinating history and politics in America and even the whole COVID issue to get his inputs and the mandates and all that kind of crazy stuff that was going on. You'll be amazed to see how good he looks for his age and enjoy the conversation. I'm delighted to meet with you here, Michael.
Well, it's good to be here, Ivor. Thank you.
And you know what, when I was a kid, I remember watching television in Ireland, and it was the British television, and there was a program on called Crime Inc., INC dot, and it went through the kind of era of the 60s and 70s and 80s as a documentary with police footage. It's quite hard hitting, and I was fascinated. But it'd be great if you gave a summary, because you actually were a big part of that era. I think in Forbes magazine, you were in the top kind of 20 or 30 leaders in that whole kind of interesting world.
Yeah, it was actually Fortune magazine that wrote an article about the 50th wealthiest and most powerful mob bosses. And they featured me as one of six that they featured. And then they have me as number 18 out of the 50 in order of rank and wealth and power. And but that was back in 1986. And it was certainly a different lifestyle, Ivor. You know, I grew up in that life. My dad, Sonny Franzese, was a powerful figure. He was the underboss of the Colombo family, one of the five New York Cosa Nostra families. So I grew up in it. My dad was a very prominent figure. Originally, he didn't want this life for me. He wanted me to go to school, be a doctor. But in the 1960s, when I was young, he got into a series of problems. He was indicted several times, went to trial four times, was actually convicted once for a major federal case and sentenced to 50 years in prison. And when he went off to do that time in 1970, I was a pre-med student, but I thought it was a death sentence for my dad. He was 50 when he went in. You figure he had 50 on top of that, he'd never come out of prison alive. So Joe Colombo was the boss of the family at that time. He kind of took me under his wing. To make a long story short, to help my dad, I decided that being part of that life would probably be the best way to benefit him. And that's what he wanted for me. He actually proposed me for membership in the life. And I got involved in the life in 1971 and became a made man in 1975, meaning that I took the oath and actually became a member of that life. And I operated in that capacity as a soldier and a captain from 1980 until about 95, I was a captain, I should say, from 80 until 95, part of that life for almost 25 years. And then it was in 95 when I decided that it was time to try to make a switch and try to walk away from that life, because it was in a lot of trouble. You know, they had come up with these new racketeering laws. A lot of guys were being indicted and jailed for 50, 100, 150 years. I had a major bullseye on my back. I was indicted seven times, you know, throughout my career in that life. So I decided to make a break, and to make a very long story short, here I am, you know, some 25 years later, married to a wonderful woman who helped me leave that life. We're married 37 years. And, you know, it's been a very blessed experience for me, you know, to have this transformation from mobster racketeer to where I am today.
Yeah, no, it's amazing transformation. And I think Michaela Peterson, I saw an interview you had with her, and I interviewed her some years back. She's an incredible girl with an incredible story. And we will talk later in this discussion on the whole health kind of sphere. But yeah, to actually transform out of that life and to get a second chance, you know, that really fascinates me. And your wife, actually, I think Catholic religion, essentially.
Well, I was born and raised a Catholic, but I practice the Christian faith now, which is similar in some ways, but we all believe in Christ and as our Savior, but we just practice and worship differently.
Yeah, exactly. And my wife actually was in the Legion of Mary, which is perceived as a pretty strong arm side of the Catholic Church, very devout when she was younger. So she didn't quite have to save me, but certainly an influence there. And the whole religion thing has been knocked for decades now. It's almost like the world turned against religion. We saw that in Ireland a lot. But that's taking away all the history and all the ideals and all of the principles like of Stoicism and all the philosophies. It's been a kind of a very difficult period for religion in the last few decades.
Yeah, no question. And I think the word religion is kind of a flashpoint because it's been misused in many ways. And obviously, we know the problem with different religions that people talk about it. And I like to say I'm not a religious person because I'm not, but I'm a person of faith. And, as a Christian, we believe is if we adhere to principles in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, that's the way to practice. It's not so much about rules and regulations and policies. It's more about a lifestyle that's emulated by Jesus Christ. And if you can walk that path, then you're going to do okay.
And likewise, I'm not particularly religious in terms of believing in God and all that, but I've got principles that align pretty much strongly with the Christian tradition in everything I do. So there's lots of ways of doing it. And your transition then was based on, your wife helping you. When you moved out of the life, you got out of prison, I think you were still pursued somewhat, were you, by the old life? I mean, you were under pretty significant threat for a period.
Yeah, you're not allowed to walk away from that life. And obviously people were very upset because I was a pretty big earner for the family. And, they lost that when I left. Aside from that, normally when people leave that life, they go into a witness protection program, they cooperate with the government. And so a lot of people thought that's what, where I was headed. And that's not what I wanted to do. I wasn't mad at anybody. I didn't want to put people in trouble. I just want that out of the life. So for walking away, there were consequences. I had a struggle for several years. We had some challenges kind of dodging the bullets, but we were able to do that on both sides because law enforcement was pretty upset with me too because I wouldn't cooperate to the degree that they wanted me to. I mean, I admitted my own dealings. I took a plea and went to jail as a result, but I wasn't trying to put other people in trouble. That's not who I am. So it was a rough time. We had several years of challenges as a result. But, I believe at the end of the day, Ivor, that God has made it very clear to me he had a different plan and purpose for my life. And I think that's why I am where I am today.
And they must have been pretty stressful times. I mean, were you literally looking over your shoulder? Were you taking countermeasures, watching everywhere you went? Evasive action or was it just a general layer of threat over your life?
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't in fear on a daily basis, but knowing the life so well, I knew what the guys would do and I knew what they wouldn't do. They're basically creatures of habit in the way they operate. So, one of the horrors of that life, Ivor, is you make a mistake, your best friend walks you into a room, you don't walk out again. So, when I left the life, I said, they're not going to walk me into a room. They're going to have to work to get me. And I moved out of New York. I moved cross country to California. It's one thing to walk you into a room when you're unaware. It's another thing to send a hit squad across the country and try to hurt you when you're aware of it. So I did that. That was the main step. And then I was very disciplined in that I didn't create patterns in my life. I didn't walk my dog every morning at 7. I didn't go to the same restaurant every Wednesday night. I didn't go to clubs anymore because I know, who hangs out in clubs. I was pretty well known. Somebody spots me. They want to be a hero. They make a call to New York. I walk out in the parking lot. I'm gone. So I was very disciplined during that time period. And it took me quite a while to make people understand that I wasn't hurting anybody. I just wanted out of the life, which is enough to get you killed. Don't get me wrong. You can't walk away. But what happened was guys had their own troubles at some point. And when they realized I'm not hurting anybody, they went on to take care of their own business. And so many of them had their own troubles. They're all in prison. I mean, it was devastating back in the 80s, what the racketeering laws led by Rudy Giuliani and the FBI, they devastated that life at that time. And so guys had their own trouble. I wasn't a threat anymore. So they, most of them either died or went to prison. So it was just, you know, again, I think it was an ordained time for me to get through all of this. And fortunately, you know, I knew the life well enough to protect myself. And that's really the explanation.
And, you know, your transition then to a kind of an inspirational speaker, multiple author, and going to speak and give your insights from that world and maybe turn people away from a world like that. Did all of that happen then just over a few years, or what was the sequence where you kind of changed yourself into this person that helps the people?
Well, you know, it happened really not by any plan of mine. It happened by accident on my part, in that I was recruited out of prison. I did 8 years total, and I was recruited out of prison to speak to all the professional sports leagues about the dangers of gambling, because I had a big gambling operation on the street. And when the FBI realized that I wasn't going back to that life, they came to me and said, we need a favor from you. We need you to cooperate with the leagues and try to help our athletes stay out of trouble with gambling. And so I was recruited as soon as I came out of prison. As a matter of fact, I was recruited in prison and then started to work with them when I got out of prison. And I went to speak to all the pro sports teams, baseball, football, the NBA. And then that moved to the college scene. And I started speaking at universities to all the student athletes. And I've been doing that for 20 some odd years. And the program really was effective because I had a lot of credibility in speaking to the athletes and telling them how we put them in trouble, what the dangers of gambling were, and how to stay out of it and avoid problems. And from there, it led to me speaking at churches. And then people were calling me for corporate events. And it just opened up. It wasn't a plan of mine, but it became a career. And it happened quite quickly. Like I said, I was recruited out of prison. When I was starting to come home, I was starting to think, you know, what is it that I'm going to do to rebuild my life? I'm now out in California. And I'm kind of entrepreneurial to begin with. So I started thinking about what to do next. And then this happened. So I was very fortunate in that regard. And it's lasted for me now. I started this back in 1995, so I've been speaking since then.
Nearly 30 years. And you know, you say that there, and that is so huge. It really, I involved in corporate management for years, and it's actually referent power. There's all these powers of leaders and success attributes, and referent power is the power you have over influencing people because of your actual expertise that's recognized. And in your case, you had a unique expertise in a very, very interesting world.
Well, you know, you learn things on the street. You're certainly not going to learn in college or in the boardroom. And, you know, one of the talents that you really have to, you have to become expert in if you're going to survive and navigate that life and really excel is reading people and managing people. You have to be able to read the room. You have to be able to know your opponent. If there is an opponent, a situation where you're at odds with somebody, because the consequences could be very severe. So you have to know how to navigate that. And you know, have to know how to manage people, because all of your people could at one point become your enemies. That's how the life is. And you have to be able to understand that. You have to know what position to put people in. You have to know how much to give them, how much not to give them. It's a treacherous life to navigate, Ivor, I can tell you that. And those that survive, I always say this, if you're a member of that life, a made member of that life, and you die of old age and you die free, you've really accomplished something.
Absolutely. And you know what? It has parallels, obviously not nearly as severe as that life, but corporate world is full of shenanigans. And what you just said there is so applicable to survival as such in the corporate world. The politics, the shenanigans, and the ruthless profiteering is extraordinary. You mentioned there, yeah, living long and surviving. Your father, I think, was 103 years old when he died.
That's correct. He died 2 years ago at the age of 103. He was the oldest living made man in America, for sure, and quite possibly in the world. I don't think anybody in that life lasted that long. At least I've never heard of anyone living that long. My dad, when he was released from prison, he did 40 years in prison total at the age of 100 in 2017. He was the oldest inmate in the system at the time of his release in America. So he's passed a few milestones, no doubt about it. But, you know, I also say this, Ivor, nobody would want his life the last 50 years of his life. It was just very challenging and very sad. He lost just about everybody that was close to him, you know, and it's a tough way to live.
Yeah, for sure. And in your case, I'll have to say, I saw you earlier, your latest video. Now, you did mention at the end, people are to stay safe and stay healthy and how important it was to stay healthy. So I would like to pivot towards health. But in your case, you're 71 years old, and that'll probably give some people watching a bit of a shock.
Yeah, I am. And, you know, I believe in that. Look, healthy mind, healthy body. Listen, you know, we only have one life to live, and we try to live it the right way. And fortunately, I'm surrounded, my family, both my wife and all my daughters, they're all nutrition, exercise. This is what they're all about. And it's a lifestyle for them. It's not like hit and miss. So I live with that. And they've had an influence on me. I mean, I've always kept myself in pretty good shape. You know, I've never gotten overweight or anything like that because it's not healthy. And, you know, look, we have good genes. My dad lived to 103, so I try to take advantage of that and sustain my health as best I could.
Right. And my last 10 years are in kind of low carbohydrate, low processed food, and, you know, fasting behaviors, and kind of tending sometimes a little towards carnivore like Michaela. But what's your kind of regime as in with those things? I always favor weight training over like running or aerobics. So maybe give us a flavor of your kind of regime day to day.
Well, my our oldest daughter is a personal trainer, and her boyfriend, probably soon to be her fiance, is also a personal trainer, and he trains me. And we train twice a week, three times a week when I can, because I'm, you know, I travel quite a bit. And a healthy diet, you know, protein for sure, low carbs. But you got to have carbs in order to put on muscle and get some energy. But always at the right time to eat them and the right type of carbs, obviously. But, you know, look, I'm also Italian and I enjoy eating. And I don't let that restrict the enjoyment of eating for me. Because honestly, Ivor, I could eat pasta every day, twice a day. You know, I love it. I grew up on it. It's my favorite meal. But I'm not fussy with foods. I eat everything. But again, you know, I don't like running. I don't like it at all. I'm not a runner. I'll get on the treadmill, you know, for 7, 8, 9, 10 minutes before I work out just to heat up my body. And we do weight training. We do weight training. And it's been working for me.
Yeah, and the weight training.
Ivor, I'll be honest with you. I don't feel any different at 71 than I felt at 30 or 35. I mean, I don't see the difference. Maybe, you know, it takes me a little bit longer to do something, and I don't even know what. I mean, I play racquetball with my 33-year-old son. I can keep up with him. I mean, I don't feel any difference. So I don't. Maybe I'm just fortunate, just blessed. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's it. If you maintain yourself, and genetics do help somewhat as well, obviously you might have some advantage there, but if you keep fit, you're doing weights, and you don't overeat, and you don't eat processed food and crap, you know, your aging is slowed down. I mean, essentially, like diabetes type 2, I'll just throw out something here that maybe listeners won't realize. from the National Institutes of Health in America around 4 years ago, just based on blood glucose, 64% of over 45s in America are either pre-diabetic or diabetic type 2. And to be honest, pre-diabetic is diabetic. And if you used insulin blood measurements, like a lot of my doctors around the world do, it'd probably be 75% or 3/4 of American adults over 45 are essentially type 2 diabetic, which is a model of accelerated aging. So, like, the extent of the metabolic disease in America, and not much different now in Europe, it's spreading, is just astonishing.
Yeah, you know, and again, you don't like to say this because people think that you're being demeaning, and we're not, you know, but you see a lot of overweight people, and that's, you know, diabetes is obviously, you know, caused by being overweight in many ways. And I just don't understand it. You know, when I gain 5 or 6 pounds, I feel so sluggish. You know, I can't even carry an additional 5 pounds without feeling it. And I almost want to tell people, do you realize what you're doing to your health? You don't mean it in a mean way. You mean it in a productive way, you know, in a helpful way. But I don't know. You know, I think the fast food industry has really caused a lot of issues with people because the food is so popular, it's so easy, and it's affordable. And I think the rise in what you just explained has a lot to do with fast food. It's my feeling.
Pretty much. And even in England, in the British Medical Journal a few years back, 60% of all calories eaten are ultra-processed foods. And whether they're fast foods or in the supermarket, most foods are ultra-processed, full of, you know, sugars, refined grains and vegetable oils. Basically, we live in a toxic food environment. So it's had the result that one could have predicted. Most people are getting diabetic, which is terrible, really. I wonder, because I see the little notice on the screen and our time, this meeting ends in around 10 minutes. I wonder, could I ask you around your perception of the COVID era over the last couple of years, and particularly in America? I know you're interested in kind of corruption and political corruption. In America, it got so polarized across the lines of Democrat, Republican. It was almost Democrat was wear masks, stay at home, you know, mandatory vaccines and all of that. And on the Republican side, it was kind of more personal freedoms, mandates are wrong, we should be making our own choices and staying safe the way we should personally. What did you think of that whole period?
Well, look, the whole COVID pandemic was politicized in a horrible way. And you're right, the progressive branch of the Democratic Party, you know, tried to take control of our lives in a big way, mandated us to do things that were unconstitutional in a way. And they've continued that. I mean, I just saw that they tried to do the same thing with monkeypox. Fortunately, it didn't spread in a way that they could do that. You know, it was all about power and control. There was so much misinformation out there, forcing people to be vaccinated. You don't force people to put something in their own bodies. And as a result, I don't know if you see this, but there was a study that was pretty horrible for me. They said that men over 40 that were vaccinated, and I believe, don't quote me on the percentage, but it was high, a 64% higher chance of having a heart attack. People that took the vaccine, as a matter of fact, if you look it up, I think it was a study that was just completed. And so many people were resistant to the vaccine, and they were ostracized for it. And they were condemned for it. And they were couldn't go into a restaurant if you weren't vaccinated. They used it really to gain power and control over our lives in this country. I think people are seeing it now, because when they tried to do that again, people were saying, no, we had enough. That's it. Stop. It was terrible what this pandemic caused. I don't think life in America will ever be the same, at least for many, many years, until maybe there is a real shift in power here. It was that bad, Ivor, really.
Yeah, and I've a lot of friends over in America from the low carb and medical networks I'm in, And they were just stunned at what happened there. Now, Europe was really bad too. And Ireland particularly was the most locked down in Europe. And without going into detail, there's over 100 published papers now. And you only need one good one that show that lockdown has no relationship to mortality or impact from SARS-CoV-2. It's a complex reason, but lockdown didn't work and it had enormous costs. But to your point on the vaccine, yeah, I think it was Ladapo, maybe the Surgeon General in Florida, maybe related to that recent study. And there was a 60 or 80% increase. But even besides side effects, the Israel data came out in mid-21 and it was clear as day. And they were the aggressive rollout and they pushed it hard. There was no difference between unvaccinated and vaccinated in case rates. And the data just flowed from mid-21 like water, showing that it did not reduce transmission. So hence, mandates or even coercion was anti-scientific, because you'd only do that if it affected the spread, not for the person themselves getting some kind of therapeutic reduction in their COVID, impact.
Absolutely. I mean, our president, made an announcement that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, which was totally false, totally untrue, nothing to support that, nothing to back it up. And then he had to, step back on that because he was vaccinated and got it twice. And everybody that was vaccinated was still getting the virus. And there was so much misinformation. I would have had a lot more respect for our people in power if they had said, look, we just don't know. This is something new. This is new ground and we're experimenting. We're trying. We're going to give you the best information. But, to impose restrictions on us with such authority of knowledge behind it that was totally false was just terrible. And a lot of people are suffering. Our youth are suffering from the school that they missed. They can't even catch up at this point in time. Life is changed here in the States, and I'm sure throughout the world. I mean, I have partners in Australia where they had a very difficult time too with the lockdowns. I mean, they were people going door to door, not letting them out of the house unless they had to go quickly to shop and then come back home. I mean, what they used that pandemic for was just, it was horrible what they did. Horrible.
Yeah, it was extraordinary times. And in April 2020, from the Diamond Princess cruise ship, the data that came out actually in February 2020, and the first published papers at the end of April 2020 from Woods Hole Institute and then The Lancet, and they all said the same thing. It's a disease of the aged, frail, overwhelmingly, and the lockdown doesn't actually really move the needle. So it was really a fascinating thing. And going forward, what do you think? You mentioned there, the future, we're going to take time to recover. But I guess the machine that drove kind of a lot of this madness, it's still there. So we're kind of up against it maybe in the coming years.
Well, listen, throughout my lifetime, I've never seen a more divisive time in the United States. People, at one time, the Democratic and the Republican Party were not too far apart in their ideology. They had some disagreements, but not too far apart. Now it's two different worlds, two different ideologies, and they hate each other. It's not like there's civil conversation or there's civil discourse anymore to try to solve the issues that we have both at home and abroad. It's just horrible. And, this starts at the top. It starts with our leadership and it trickles down to, our citizens and our general population. And I've never seen anything like this before, honestly. And I'd say it a lot because I spent a lot of time on the street. I've never seen a country more divided than I've seen now. And I don't know what the end result is. I will say this, these midterm elections here in the United States are probably the most important in my lifetime. They're going to be that decisive one way or the other.
Yeah, and I'm watching with interest too, because America is still a huge force in the world, and what happens there and the outcome of those elections is going to dictate a lot of what happens in Europe, to be quite honest. So given your massive experience with people then, I know a lot of people who almost kind of despair, and I try and reassure them with the craziness of lockdown, the craziness of mandates. huge amounts of people losing their jobs based on a medication that doesn't affect transmission. So a lot of people kind of lose hope a bit. They feel really stressed. How can you help those people in your mind? I mean, from your experience or advice for those people?
Yeah, a lot of my hopeful attitude, I should say, comes from my faith, because again, you know, as Christians, we know how this is all going to end. And we also know that there's going to be suffering here on earth. We get it. We're going to have challenges, but a lot depends on your outlook in life. You know, I happen to be a pretty optimistic person. I think that, throughout my life, I've been able to overcome a lot of different challenges. So I'm just that type of person. I have that determination, and I try to instill that in others. And, you know, have your own method and technique in doing that, you know, and that basically is getting into the little bit of the psychology of that person, knowing what they've gone through, what they've been through in their life, and then just uplifting them in a way that, you know, I think that, I'm qualified to do, because I've been doing it now for 25 years. And like I said, you get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing people enlightened. And, you know, every single day, Ivor, and I mean this, every day, not a day passes, either in social media or emails, do I get a message from someone that says that they've been uplifted, inspired by the message, and it's been a life-changing message. And, you know, when you hear that, you say, hey, this is what you're supposed to be doing. And you just continue to do it and uplift people. And, I've been very blessed in that regard.
Yeah, well, I must say, Michael, that resonates so much with me. And in my own small way, all the work I did on this COVID thing, data analysis and explaining risk and all that stuff, just endless people saying, actually, you've saved my sanity, because they were wondering, were they going kind of mad? But certainly helping people, I always say, stoicism is the most powerful kind of virtue in ways, and it has strong ties. The Christian tradition and religions in general, stoicism was a huge thing. And it's just realizing there's no point worrying about what actually does happen in the future. You know, that's kind of fate. You need to worry about, what do I do to make the world better? What do I do to react to challenges? And bring it all back to what you can do, and not worry about what you can't affect. You know, isn't that the core of it?
No, and that's it. I mean, you can only worry about what you have control over. And what you don't have control over, well, you try to navigate through it as best you can. And if you can, you are in a position to make a difference, then you do that. You try your best to do that. So, and when you come to that realization, again, that things that are out of your control, you just navigate through them the best you can. I think it's very, very helpful. You know, I kind of lived my life that way even before I became a person of faith, and that was only strengthened and heightened as a person of faith.
Yep. And you never need to look back with regret, because you always did what you could do within your control, and that's all anyone could ever ask of themselves. So that's the way to approach it. But you can't inject, even by mandate, stoicism into people. But yeah, hopefully using powers of persuasion and your expertise, or my management expertise in my world, you can just help, you know, communicate this to people in a, I don't know, a meaningful way that resonates with them, and help them ultimately. That's what it's all about.
Well, we agree on that. And I'm glad you're doing your part, and I'll continue to do my part. And, you know, we'll see where it all ends.
That's it, Michael. Well, I know we both got to run, and you particularly, mindful of your time. Think you're doing fantastic work, and maybe we'll circle back in a few months and continue the conversation or into different areas.
Anytime, Ivor, and you've been such a gentleman in understanding the, you know, some of the time constraints I've had on me. You know, since I got back from Europe, spending that 2 months there, it's been a lot of catch up. And I've had a lot of traveling dates since then. So I hit the ground running the moment I came back. And as a matter of fact, this is the first 9 or 10 day stretch that I'll have being home, you know, since June. So it's good.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate your time. Delighted, honored to have you on the pod. And yeah, we'll circle back in the future, maybe with less challenging times.
You got it, my friend. You have a good rest of your evening, I think. It's a little belated by you. And And we'll stay in touch.
Excellent, Michael. Thank you.
God bless. Take care. Thank you.
Special thanks to my friend John O'Kelly for connecting me with Michael. And also huge thanks, as always, to all my Patreons, PayPal supporters. And the links are down below, and really appreciate people who continue to support me or those who have the means to support me in the future. Also, it really helps to like, subscribe, and hit the little notification bell to keep in touch. And also comment under the videos and share them with your friends. That really helps all of us too in this somewhat battle against corporate misinformation and mass and legacy media misinformation that we're inundated with in today's corrupt times. So thank you all.